Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. Now we continue our 30 Issues election series with Issue 24, Equal Pay for Equal Work, and maybe even comparable work. Let's listen to some history.
I'm pleased that we can meet together today as the Equal Pay Act of 1963 goes into effect all across this great land of ours.
President Lyndon Johnson signing a law that was a century in the making. A history article in Time magazine cites a letter to the editor of the New York Times in 1869, noting that the U.S. Treasury Department employed 500 women, but they only made $900 a year on average, half what men were making for the same jobs. Congress passed an equal pay bill for federal workers the next year, 1870, but it didn't cover state and local government employees or any of the private sector. In 1883, Western Union telegraph workers went on strike for equal pay in that corner of the private sector, but the strike failed to achieve its goals. It took until 1911 for New York City public school teachers to be granted equal pay, according to Time. And as late as the 1960s, newspapers had help wanted men and help wanted women listings in their classified sections, sometimes offering lower pay in the women's listings for the same exact jobs. One thing that was good for the equal pay movement in the 20th century was war. When the government wanted men to go and fight in World Wars I and II, women took more civilian jobs. Here's 48 seconds of a 1943 government film made to recruit women into factory work.
Women are called upon to leave their homes and take jobs. Among our young unmarried women and among older women whose children are grown, we have a large reserve. They discover that factory work is usually no more difficult than housework. Employers find that women can do many jobs as well as men, some jobs better. Tens of thousands of women are already at work in aircraft. More are being added as fast as they apply. This solves the breadwinning problem for many families whose men are at war. The government's policy is that women should get the same pay that men get for similar work. Where necessary, machinery is adapted for women's use. When a hand drill weighs heavily on feminine muscles, the lazy arm drill is introduced to take off the strain.
Now, for some reason, that 1943 film to recruit women into factory work was called Manpower. After the war, so many women left out of the home workforce, went back into the home, but there was a new impetus to pass an equal pay law that covered the private sector for women who did work outside the home. And men tended to support that effort. They didn't want their jobs devalued by employers who thought that they could hire women in those jobs for lower wages. President Kennedy supported an equal pay bill in 1962.
Well, we are attempting to make sure that the women, for example, who work, one-third of our working force are women. We want to try to encourage every company in the United States and certainly stimulate governmental leadership in providing equal pay and equal conditions for women. 22 states do it now. We can do a much better job on that.
That was JFK in 62. In 63, the Equal Pay Act passed over the objection of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and other business groups. President Lyndon Johnson addressed a group of women about it at the White House in 1964.
So America's progress toward a society of decency has been marked and measured by our attitudes toward the role and toward the rights of our women. We have made America stronger, not softer, as we have laid aside, gradually, one by one, the old biases and the ancient prejudices against the equality of women. One-third of our working force are women, but they receive only about one-fifth of the pay. The average full-time woman worker receives nearly $2,500 less than the average full-time male worker. This law is not a pay raise law, but it does say that wherever men and women do the same work, whether at the workbench or the office desk, they shall be paid equal wages for equal work. Let's open the door wider for all, just as we have opened it today for women.
A minute and a quarter of President Johnson in 1964. Note that he cited a stat in that clip that a third of the workforce back then was already women, but they made only a fifth of the pay. That gap is smaller today, but it is hardly gone. Women today make on average 80 cents for every dollar a man makes, according to the most widely published recent stats. One reason for that is that just because there's an Equal Pay Act on the books doesn't mean employers always obey it. So the next political battle after the Equal Pay Act of 1963 was passed was for meaningful enforcement of equal pay. Here's Vice President Al Gore in 1998 arguing for a bill that would impose consequences on employers who still engaged in pay discrimination.
So today, on behalf of President Clinton, who has fought tirelessly for pay equity, I'm proud to announce our strong support of the bill sponsored by Congresswoman DeLauro and Senator Daschle to strengthen the Equal Pay Act, and we will fight for this legislation. I call on Congress to pass this bill into law to give women compensatory and punitive damages when an employer pursues a wrongful policy of unequal pay.
Not just compensatory, but punitive damages to be given to the women in that 1990s bill, Vice President Gore in 1998. The back and forth over enforcement has been going on ever since, both in Congress and in the courts. Now, one important Supreme Court case came in 2007 when the Roberts Court ruled 5-4 that a Goodyear Tire and Rubber Company employee named Lily Ledbetter was not entitled to years of back pay for sex discrimination that she had proven. The issue was the court's interpretation of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. It said sex discrimination cases must be brought within 180 days of the discriminatory act. Ledbetter had brought her suit within 180 days of discovering she was getting unequal pay, but the court said she was not entitled to all the years of back pay to make up for all the time she was cheated before the most recent 180 days. Under President Bush, Congress could not pass a bill to change that law, and in the 2008 presidential election, John McCain opposed it too. But the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act became the first bill that President Obama signed into law when he took office in 2009. It clarifies the civil rights law to state that the clock for filing a lawsuit resets to 180 days after each discriminatory paycheck covering the ones that came before.
Now, equal pay is by no means just a women's issue. It's a family issue. It's about parents who find themselves with less money for tuition and childcare, couples who wind up with less to retire on, households where one breadwinner is paid less than she deserves. That's the difference between affording the mortgage or not, between keeping the heat on or paying the doctor bills or not. And in this economy, when so many folks are already working harder for less and struggling to get by, the last thing they can afford is losing part of each month's paycheck to simple and plain discrimination. So signing this bill today is to send a clear message that making our economy work means making sure it works for everybody.
President Obama in 2009. So equal pay for equal work is the law of the land, and there are some guarantees for enforcement. Progress is possible, but it's not complete. Equal pay still isn't always offered. There are various reasons more women are in lower-paying jobs, and the question of equal pay for comparable jobs has been a political non-starter. It's our 30 Issues election series. Issue 24, equal pay for equal and what about comparable work. We'll compare the current candidates' positions on this later in the week. With me now to discuss some of the history we just heard is Heidi Hartman, president and founder of the Washington-based Institute for Women's Policy Research. She founded it in 1987 to conduct woman-centered policy research. Thanks so much for doing this, Ms. Hartman. Welcome to WNYC.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
The basic concept is kind of shockingly obvious from today's sensibilities, right? If you're doing the exact same work, you should get the exact same pay, whether you're a man or a woman. But that wasn't obvious earlier in our history?
Well, it really wasn't. I mean, I love the example of the clerical workers at the Treasury Department making 50% of the men back in the late 1860s. And as late as the 1930s, really, that was an era when we had industrial organization and human resource policies, you know, coming into force, as modern scientific processes in the workplace. And they would do job evaluations of the men's and women's jobs. And it would be often on a point system for this factor, responsibility, effort, working conditions, whatever. And there were some well-known corporations at the time that would say, okay, this man's job gets 100 points and this women's job gets 100 points, but we discount the women's pay by 20%. And even though they had had a system that said that, you know, even though these jobs were not identical, they were worth the same in terms of skill, effort, working conditions, and responsibility. And that was common practice, that it was perfectly fine to pay women less. And, you know, pretty much everybody did it. And it really began to be a lot of momentum for change during World War II. And many, many times women thought they would get an equal pay bill, which included, by the way, language on comparable worth. All of the drafts included language on comparable worth. They thought they would get it long before 1963. And when they finally got it, it was limited to equal pay for equal work.
And we'll come back to comparable worth in a couple of minutes. I was surprised reading the Time magazine history. I didn't know that New York City public school teachers were paid more if they were men until 1911. So I guess that was considered okay by sensibilities until then. And I was reading that in World War I, men went off to war and women went into civilian jobs that the government decided they could fill. And there were actual lists of jobs under the designation woman's work. That was an official federal government category during World War I, woman's work. Do you happen to know what are some of the jobs that got onto that list? I realize that's a very specific piece of history. I don't know if you know it.
I don't really, but I would imagine many clerical jobs. I think New York City was progressive if they eliminated unequal pay for women teachers in 1911. I mean, many school districts had it much, much longer.
How big a landmark was the Equal Pay Act of 1963?
Well, it was huge. I mean, it was the first time this was addressed in national legislation. And it had an enforcement mechanism, which was the Department of Labor, the Wage and Hours Unit, and it was followed, I think you might have had a quote on that in your history, by the executive order of Lyndon Johnson, which required federal contractors to not only pay equally, but to also not discriminate in hiring and promotion. And that, of course, was an echo or similar to the 64 mm-hmm. Civil Rights Act. So the
right.
two
so
things
that
together,
executive order to order meant not just actual federal workers, but federal contractors in the private sector, too. They had to adhere to the same standards if they were going to get paid by the taxpayers.
That's right. And really, because the 1964 Civil Rights Act followed so closely upon the 1963 Equal Pay Act, you know, they both kind of blur together in terms of what their impacts were. It, of course, is enforced by the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. Many people don't think sex was included from the beginning, but it was. But the common sense is, the sense of most historians is that the agency did very little about sex discrimination or gender for quite some time. So it was in there, but they were not necessarily going after hiring and promotion discrimination, is my understanding.
Also on enforcement, President Obama is still fighting Congress in several ways. I'm reading now from the website Info, Please, and it says, in April 2014, he signed two executive orders to help eliminate wage disparities among federal contract workers. One order bans federal contractors from punishing workers who discuss salaries with coworkers, and the other calls on the Labor Department to create rules that require federal contractors to submit salary information broken down by race and gender to the federal government. The day after Obama signed the orders, Senate Republicans blocked a vote on the Paycheck Fairness Act, which would have imposed the measures included in the executive orders on the entire American workforce. It was the third time since 2010 that the Senate failed to consider the legislation. So for you as an activist in these areas or a advocate kind of researcher, would you like to see the government go that far, that every private employer has to provide salary information to the government broken down by race and gender? Employers would certainly find that onerous.
Well, that's an interesting question, and it's being worked on right now in the executive branch. First of all, let me clarify that IWPR is a research organization. We do not lobby. Of course, our research tends to show disparities, and when we are asked to testify, we do. And certainly we're happy to talk to the media about our research. Mm-hmm. My own personal view is that Paycheck Fairness Act, which hasn't passed yet, should be passed. Obviously, we still have a lot of wage disparity. I think you mentioned it was 80%. It's women are now making, according to data released a few weeks ago, 79.6%, generally rounded to 80% of what men make for year-round full-time work. So there's still a problem. On the data collection, it probably isn't that onerous. First of all, it wouldn't apply to every single employer, but only those that file the EEO-1, which I believe is in general, companies with more than 100 workers. Most of those companies are already using automated payroll systems, and they already know the race and gender of their workers by occupation because they report that on the EEO-1. And since they already know that and they have automated pay, it's reasonably easy for them to calculate what would be the average pay, say, of full-time men and women working in broad occupational categories. The broad occupational categories that are being proposed are the same ones that they already report to the government on the EEO-1 form. And these are not data about any individual. These are broad occupational categories. And they would not be made available to the public. They're considered confidential. What a researcher can get is, the kind of, here's a gazillion companies and here's what they filed, but you won't know which company filed which form. So for researchers, it would be, useful to improve the research that can now be done with the EEO-1 forms. You can already use them for research, but now there would be wage data attached. So I don't actually view it personally as that onerous.
So they're already reporting the race and gender makeup of their workforces. You're saying this would just attach wage information to that form.
The average wage information, right, for the men and women by different race groups in that large occupational category. A large occupational category is like managers, clerical workers, blue-collar workers. These are big, very big categories. But it would still be helpful, and I believe it would be helpful to the enforcement agencies to see where the issues are.
As we talk for another few minutes about equal pay for equal work, issue 24 in our 30 issues election series, Jim in the Bronx is calling in. Jim, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question. Would comparable work rules forbid distinctions in pay based on seniority, experience, or rank? For instance, I'm in academia, and of course we have different ranks within the profession, adjuncts, lecturers, assistant professors, full professors, based on experience, based on publications and this sort of thing. But we all teach more or less exactly the same classes for exactly the same number of hours per week. So would a comparable wage law forbid distinctions based on rank, on experience, on seniority, on ability?
Jim, that's a great
question. Teach you exactly the same kinds of materials.
Great question. And Heidi Hartman, before we even get to the question of comparable worth, which is his specific question, the Equal Pay Act already makes exceptions even for people in the exact same job, for things like merit and seniority when those are considered qualifications in a particular workforce. Is that correct?
That's correct, yeah. And the same, to my knowledge, would apply in comparable worth. Where you might see something for a college professor would be that the nursing professor would be considered comparable to the engineering professor, and those salaries might be brought up. I'm willing to bet that the nursing professors are on a much lower scale. So full professor rank two in nursing with 30 years experience probably makes less than full professor rank two in engineering with 30 years of experience. So that's the kind of thing where you would expect across disciplines might be they might be brought into alignment.
So maybe that's why this has been a failed political movement so far, the comparable worth movement, not just equal pay for equal work. The idea that the government would get involved in identifying all kinds of jobs, and that's as good an example as any, nursing professors compared to engineering professors, and the government is going to say, no, we deem these comparable, and so the pay scales have to be the same. Is that the idea?
Well, it's not exactly the idea. The idea is that the government would require the employer to investigate what jobs are incomparable in their own firms and pay them the same. So everything is always left up to the employer. And then, of course, just like now, you could sue for unequal pay in the same job, then you'd be able to sue for unequal pay in a comparable job. So interestingly enough, this was not always a failed movement. In the 70s and 80s, we had a number of lawsuits that were won at various levels of the court system, and whole state civil services changed their pay to bring women's pay closer to men's pay on average across the board. And they did that. I mean, it didn't get equal, but it got closer. And they did that by bringing up the wages of what were considered, when they did these job evaluation schemes, undervalued jobs. And
can you give me an example or two?
Well, prison guards, that was one of the cases. Male and female guards, guards in male prisons and female prisons were being paid differently. And you might think that job was the same, but it was kind of considered a comparable job because there were different duties involved. But the overall thing would be an entire civil service. So maybe secretaries would be brought up, librarians would be brought up, nurses would be brought up. You know, in some places, child care workers were making less than parking lot attendants who worked for a city or a state. So those would be brought up. Minnesota passed laws saying that counties and localities had to do comparable worth studies and improve the pay alignment of jobs that were found to be similar. So in the reason it focused on the public sector is that that's where there was wage information. Generally, wages are public in the public sector, so you know, a child care worker can say, wait, the parking guy is making more than me, and complain about it. And they have politicians that they can appeal to. And so these laws were passed and studies were done and wages were raised. So it did happen. But finally, there was a negative case from the Supreme Court. And at that time, you know, the advocates thought it was covered by Title VII. And then new legislation was written. It has a name, I think it's called the Fair Pay Act. President Obama, when he was in the Senate, was one of 11 senators to support the Fair Pay Act. So the Fair Pay Act is still often introduced in Congress. I'm not sure if it's absolutely every session. But you're absolutely right, it has gone nowhere in recent history. But it is out there as an idea still, and I think it will come back because people will realize that you can't get rid of the whole pay gap unless you do a better job on comparable pay, and unless you do a better job essentially on affirmative action, on integrating the best paid jobs, like whether they're in STEM or whether it's CEO of a Fortune 500 company. If we don't start seeing a more equal representation of women in all those jobs and better pay for, let's say, home health care workers, we won't see completely equal pay.
John in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, John.
Hi, thanks for having me on, and I love this conversation, and I love the guest. A quick question about, for the guest, Freakonomics did a really interesting story about this earlier in the summer, and they had Claudia Golden, who I guess is an economics professor at Harvard, and she said that this is a way more complicated story, and I would love the guest's thoughts on this, but she said basically equal pay for equal work was really a closer to like a 95% gap, and it's the complications or the complexities in the disparity really comes from what she called like a care bias, in that we as a society look way more for women to take the lead in childcare, and as a result, that that has a bigger impact. Now, I don't know if that's true, but I thought it was interesting.
Yeah.
And Stephen Dubner reported it is true. So I would love to hear the guest thoughts on, I'm sort of hearing both sides of this, and I would love to hear a response to that.
Right. So when we say 80 cents that a woman makes for every dollar a man makes, does that take into account that women on average work fewer hours per year if they have children at home than men do? And women sometimes are on a slower track of even what jobs they will take because of the childcare responsibilities that they take on more than the men in the kids' lives?
Well, first I want to say, gee, if Steve Dubner said it was true, it must be true. But seriously,
words that I live by all the time.
Claudia Golden and I talk often and exchange views on these matters, and we have great respect for each other. First of all, I think most economists agree that the fact that women are doing more of the family work is affecting their job prospects. Many of them do work less than full-time, but that ratio that we use is for full-time year-round workers. Now, even within that, men on average do work more hours, but it's not enough more to account for the whole 20% gap.
Right. So last question, and then we're going to did you want to finish something on that?
Well, just to say that we lag what other countries have in terms of paid family leave, child care support, all of those things, and I think Claudia would agree if we could do more of them here, we would see women's wages catch up a bit.
So last question. I read that the gap for women under 25 is much smaller. It's like 94 cents for every dollar. Older women have more of a gap. Does that mean we're going to age out of equal pay disparities as equity becomes a standard practice and a cultural value?
I wish. But this phenomenon of younger women doing better than older women has been around for about 50 years. I mean, it goes up with every new cohort of women, so 94 is probably the best ratio that younger women have had. But as they age, the gap grows, and that's happened to every past cohort, and I imagine it will happen to this one. And, of course, you know, many people speculate it has to do with the childbearing years. But not all women have children, and yet all women seem to suffer from this disadvantage, you could say, that, well, you could have had children or you might have had children, or anyway, you did have a child 30 years ago. What difference does it make if you had a child 30 years ago and you took a year off at the time? So it's unfortunately, a kind of cultural thing that to pay women less is still accepted in many ways, and women's jobs pay less. So, you know, we're going to have to make a lot of changes to get where we want to be.
Heidi Hartman, president and founder of the Institute for Women's Policy Research. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's our 30 Issues Election Series, Issue 24, Equal Pay for Equal and What About Comparable Work? We'll compare the current candidates' positions tomorrow. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. More to come. Stay with us.